G.I. Joe is ready for combat, the schiff hits the fan in California, and cinema's departure leaves us with a sense of Yuma on The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 411 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. An old 81-year-old guy entered the House chamber on Thursday evening, the subject of Democratic worries and Republican taunts, with a nation concerned that he may not have the vigor and acuity to lead the country for another 4 years. Less than 2 hours later, Joe Biden was a conquering hero for the Democrats, strongly making the case for not only his re-election, but listing all the reasons why his predecessor, yes, Donald Trump, should never return to the White House. And if he wasn't drawing differences between himself and his predecessor, he was lecturing the majority House Republicans on the errors of their ways.
Now my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, do whatever the hell you want. That's a quote. My predecessor came to office determined to see Roe v. Wade overturned. He's the reason it was overturned, and he brags about it. But my predecessor and many in this chamber want to take this prescription drug away by repealing the Affordable Care Act. I'm not going to let that happen. I will not demonize immigrants saying they are poison in the blood of our country. My predecessor told the NRA he's proud he did nothing on guns when he was president. Oof. After another shooting in Iowa recently, he said, when asked what to do about it, he said, just get over it. There is his quote, just get over it. The working people who built this country pay more into Social Security than millionaires and billionaires do. It's not fair. We have two ways to go. Republicans can cut Social Security and give more tax breaks to the wealthy. That's the proposal. Oh, no. You guys don't want another $2 trillion tax cut? I kind of thought that's what your plan was. Well, that's good to hear. You're not going to cut another $2 trillion for the super wealthy. That's good to hear. I'll protect and strengthen Social Security and make the wealthy pay their fair share.
This was not the sleepy Joe we were expecting. The guy elected in 2020 as a conciliator, willing to work across the aisle to get things done? No. It has long been clear that Republicans have no interest in working with him. This was an in-your-face speech that told the world he was ready for the brutal fight that awaits him. And it will be brutal. And the House chamber became the Roman Colosseum. Marjorie Taylor Greene led her band of Republican hyenas with catcalls and insults, while Democrats serenaded the president with chants of 4 more years. Biden made a conscious decision to leave the customary list of agenda items usually heard at a State of the Union address and make it a pure campaign rally. Such addresses are rarely remembered. This one will. If State of the Union addresses are often quickly forgotten, the same can be said about the response by the Out Party, times 10. The Out Party's response is usually one of the more thankless jobs in politics. Nobody remembers effective rebuttals. They do remember poor performances, like the ones given by Bobby Jindal years ago. And remember Marco Rubio's reach for a water bottle?
In the short time that I've been here in Washington, nothing has frustrated me more than false choices like the one the president laid out tonight. The choice isn't just between big government or big business. What we need is an accountable, efficient...
But nothing I can remember topped what we heard last Thursday.
And the Oscar goes to...
Say hi to Katie Britt, a Republican senator from Alabama, at 42, the youngest Republican woman ever elected to the Senate. The fact that everybody now knows her name is not a good thing. Her 17-minute speech continuously alternated between a melodramatic, fierce, grim, angry, and stern face, and a welcoming, patronizing, smiling, friendly face. Both extremes were odd and exaggerated. She was overcoached. She was baffling and bizarre. Her decision to speak from her kitchen seemed to play to age-old stereotypes. Saturday Night Live opened its show 2 days later with a spoof of her speech. It's not going to be easy to relay to you how jarring her speech was. I'm going to play a meme on social media that takes a snippet from three normal conversations Britt had and contrasts it with three of the exaggerated things we heard on Thursday night. I hope this works.
I am looking forward to delivering the Republican response to the State of the Union, so tune in.
President Biden's border policies are a disgrace. This crisis is despicable. And the truth is, it is almost entirely preventable.
And thank you to all the gentlemen behind me who continue to work diligently to actually secure our border. That's what the American people deserve. But unfortunately, Joe Biden refuses to give that to them.
Mr. President, enough is enough. Innocent Americans are dying, and you only have yourself to blame.
Everything that we put forth that would actually secure and close the border, the Democrats don't want. This is yet another prong of the failed Bidenomics.
The American people are scraping by while President Biden proudly proclaims that Bidenomics is working. Bless his heart.
Since her rebuttal, we have heard no shortage of analysis suggesting that her political career will forever be scarred. That remains to be seen. But between Trump's near-total sweep on Super Tuesday and Biden's bring-it State of the Union, one thing is clear. The rematch from 2020 is on. One of the most fascinating members of Congress, and now perhaps one of the most complex, Kyrsten Sinema announced this week that she would not seek a second term in the Senate. Elected as a Democrat in 2018, she became an independent in 2022 and often made life as difficult as possible for President Biden and his allies in such a closely divided body. We were long awaiting her decision about her election plans. We got it on Tuesday.
The only political victories that matter these days are symbolic. Attacking your opponents on cable news or social media. Compromise is a dirty word. We've arrived at that crossroad, and we chose anger and division. I believe in my approach, but it's not what America wants right now. I love Arizona, and I am so proud of what we've delivered. Because I choose civility, understanding, listening, working together to get stuff done, I will leave the Senate at the end of this year.
Her announcement, not really a surprise, took a prospective three-way race and made it a one-on-one contest between Democratic Congressman Ruben Gallego and unsuccessful Republican gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake. Of course, Sinema's explanation that she's quitting because the voters no longer believe in compromise may not be that simple. For more, we go to Ron Hansen, the national political reporter with the Arizona Republic. Ron, it's good having you back on the program.
Thanks, Ken. Happy to talk to you.
Is it fair to say that no one or very few were surprised by Sinema's decision?
You know, I think by the time it came about, it really was not a surprise. The calendar was just getting so deep into the process. He had about a month to gather 60,000 signatures, roughly, leaving herself some margin for error for the 42,000 threshold. It was getting more and more expensive, and she had never really indicated that she was running anyway. So, yeah, by the time it landed, it was sort of anticlimactic.
She didn't seem like she was having a lot of fun lately. I mean, of course, I think she, like Joe Manchin, I mean, Joe Manchin loved the attention. And I'm not sure if Sinema loved the attention or not, but there were scenes where she's running into a ladies' room in an airport and activists are chasing her. It couldn't have been that much fun.
You know, I think she enjoyed being a senator, the part that happens behind closed doors, the Senate floor and all the trappings of the office. But the other part of it, the public facing, public interactions, that aspect of it is something that she shunned. She was never one to appear before the cameras much in the national media or even locally. And it really helped contribute to a sense of aloofness and an estrangement from her base.
You know, that's strange. I was thinking as you were saying that I had her on Talk of the Nation on NPR right after she, twice actually I had her on, right after she was elected to the House in 2012. And she was so full of hope and so optimistic and so willing to talk. And she was really delightful. And I don't picture her having delight in answering reporters' questions in any, you know, in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot about her that has changed. She's definitely a political riddle. For those of us in Arizona who remember her in the state legislature, her gregarious personality, she is funny. She's just a funny person, or can be. To become as straight-laced as she was and unavailable in many ways to her constituents, it really was something where she seemed to hold back her personality. And as she continued to evolve, of course, starting with the Green Party back in the early days ahead of the Iraq War, to where she has become sort of more comfortable among Republicans. It's been quite the evolution, both personally and politically.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. I mean, she was a Green Party member. She liked presidential candidate Ralph Nader. And now she's seen as some, you know, corporate sellout who of course, you know, stymied much of Biden's agenda. Let me play an ad put out by the Working Families Party.
Kyrsten Sinema, what happened? You promised you'd be independent and put us first. But now you're blocking the Build Back Better Act, which would lower health care costs, cut pollution, and create 125,000 jobs in Arizona. So what the... Is it the millions of dollars you've received from corporate interests? You promised you'd never let them buy your vote. So keep your word to us. Put Arizona first and pass the Build Back Better Act.
And she was also mocked on SNL.
What do I want from this bill? I'll never tell. Because I didn't come to Congress to make friends. And so far, mission accomplished.
She said she was retiring because voters didn't believe in compromise. But why do you think she was retiring?
Yeah, I think one thing that we've known about Kyrsten Sinema for a while is she was very data-driven, very disciplined in terms of understanding how to get to a win politically or legislatively. She was always astute at that aspect of it. I think she just saw the cold, hard facts that there was no viable path to winning her Senate reelection campaign. Arizona Democrats had so fully turned against her. And Republicans, who, you know, no surprise, wanted a Republican. And there was no path for her running as an independent. And she left essentially blaming the voters, blaming Congress for not embracing the centrism that she tries to represent. But at the end of the day, there was just no market for what she was selling.
You know, she did that famous curtsy when she offered a thumbs down on raising the minimum wage.
Miss Sinema, no.
This is the enigma of Kyrsten Sinema. Legislatively, there are a few senators who could lay claim to as much consequential legislation and just being at the center, sort of being the fulcrum of the political agenda in Washington as Kyrsten Sinema. It's not that she didn't put her name to important bills or give the thumbs down that mattered in the end. It was the sort of emotional things, the things that people remember about just stylistically how she carried herself, how she was dismissive of people in her base. Those are the kinds of things that just didn't wear well in Arizona and sort of became the aura that she carried with her and became a national caricature at times.
I think it's fair to say that if anyone is more known in Arizona than Kyrsten Sinema, it's Carrie Lake. She lost a very close race for governor in 2022, but certainly more memorably, she still refuses to acknowledge her defeat. I'm going to play a little bit of her answer on this video put out by Right Wing Watch. It's a website as to why she refuses to join a recall movement against Katie Hobbs, the Democrat who beat her.
I already beat her once. I'm not going to open it up and recall someone who shouldn't be sitting there in the first place. You recall somebody who was elected who you don't like the way they're operating. She wasn't elected. And so I'm not taking part in that. She wasn't elected. She's a fraud. She's sitting in the governor's office. They've stolen our government. And that's why I'm not taking part in that. I won this election and everybody involved knows it. This woman should be pulled out by her collar. She doesn't belong in there. And a whole bunch of other people should be pulled out by their collars for the fraud. It's disgusting what they did. And that's why I fight. And that's why I haven't, moved on yet from what this fight is. I have to fight this. And if I do decide to run for another office, I will still never give up this fight. I will never concede to this loser named Hobbs. That will never be happening. So if she's listening or her minions are,
I hope she gets to see it.
There will never be a concession ever, ever.
How is Lake's refusal to give up playing with the electorate?
You know, it's something that voters in Arizona have not rewarded election denialism. We saw that loud and clear in the 2022 midterms. Carrie Lake's gubernatorial loss to Katie Hobbs owed very heavily to what I think was an agenda that seemed to be just unrewarding to other Republicans and very threatening to the independence that either party needs to win in Arizona. And it wasn't just her. We saw that with Mark Fincham in the Secretary of State's race. We saw it with Blake Masters in the U.S. Senate race, that anybody who had that kind of election denialism aura about them went down in flames on a night in Arizona when other Republicans did pretty well. And it's something that Senate leadership in Washington has urged and asked and pleaded with Carrie Lake to drop the election denialism because they want to turn the page, talk about other issues, whether it's the economy or the border. And Lake, even on the day that Sinema announced her retirement, she happened to be in Washington that day and was still talking about denialism when asked. And it's the kind of thing that she just can't get off the agenda.
But at the same time, these people who may be criticizing Lake's refusal to concede are backing a guy for president who also refuses to concede.
Yeah, it is an interesting dynamic. It's something one person I spoke with this week noted that there's almost this sort of paradox that Donald Trump can talk about John McCain how he wants, but when Carrie Lake does it, he really catches fire from the McCain family. Or when she talks about denialism, it's something that voters seem to not reward, but they're open to a Trump presidency. It is the sort of thing that is often the case. The Trump measuring stick is a little different than everyone else's.
Carrie Lake, said that she was just joking when she mocked John McCain or became a critic of John McCain. What's her relationship with the McCain wing of the state GOP now?
Well, I don't think she done much to endear herself to that element. There's still a direct friction with Meghan McCain, who speaks for Meghan McCain. The McCain family certainly did nothing to intervene and welcome Carrie Lake's recent remark, trying to suggest it was a joke. I think we can all infer from that the hurt and the disagreement with it is still there. For the wider McCain world, those who are still interested and active in politics, they really haven't put the arm around Carrie Lake's candidacy yet. The rest of official Washington in Republican circles has. And I think that there's a question of You know, as this race gets closer to the fall, will any of those folks fall into line? So far, we really haven't seen it.
Given the fact that she was so critical of McCain, given the fact that she seems to continue to use scorched earth tactics regarding her 22 governor's race, why are state Republicans so eager to rally around her for the Senate race?
I think the shortest answer is that they don't have much of a choice. The fact is, Carrie Lake has quite a sizable base within Republican voters in Arizona. She is the heavy favorite to win the primary. She does face a primary opponent in Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb, but she is unbeatable on that level, is the expectation. That means that they're stuck with her in the general election, and they know that the formula in Arizona, really since 2018, has been a fight for independence. It's not enough to just turn out a Republican base. So I think those the political pros know that the party needs to appeal to a broader slice of the electorate than just the hard right. Lake makes that a hard sell.
Well, like I did earlier with Sinema, Carrie Lake also felt the wrath of Saturday Night Live comedy writers. Let me play a little bit right now.
Nearly every candidate Trump backed lost this week, except for one who's still hanging on by a thread, and she's here with us today. Please welcome Carrie Lake.
Hello there. Hi. And greetings from Arizona, where the average age and temperature is 95.
Hi, Carrie, and thanks for being here during what must be a very stressful time for your campaign.
Hey, my campaign isn't dead yet, even though my camera filter makes it look like I'm in heaven.
Now, Carrie, it seemed like this was a race you'd easily win, yet it's been a real nail-biter. You and your opponent are currently neck and neck.
That is because the Maricopa County officials are incompetent, and it's my belief that the election is rigged and the results should be thrown out.
It sounds like some new numbers are coming in, which has you taking a narrow lead over Katie Hobbs.
Which is why I have always said this is a democracy. Trust the system. Trust the voters.
Sorry, I spoke too soon. Another batch of votes just came in, and you are now losing again.
Because our system is broken, and it always has been.
Wait, I'm sorry, I misread that. You're actually back in the lead.
But thankfully, now it's fixed. Look, I am 100% confident I'm going to win this election. And I won't stop fighting until every vote is counted, and then some votes are taken away. Because who do Arizonans want leading them? Katie Hobbs, who's hiding in a basement? Or me, Carrie Lake, who lives right here in this beautiful pool of Vaseline, and who's out there every single day at CVS asking black customers if they work here?
That was Cecily Strong, who played both Sinema and Lake, I think, to perfection. Okay, now tell me about the Democrat, Ruben Gallego. Is he in a position to take advantage of a growing Latino voting bloc in the state?
Well, you would presume that he would be. He is Latino himself, and he has represented Arizona in Congress since the 2014 elections. So he's well known in his district and in the Maricopa County area. He has some visibility. I think the real question about him is whether he has the identity that's fully formed around the state. That seems to not be the case yet. And whether he is too far to the left for mainstream voters who have not rewarded or elected a candidate like that in Arizona, even in this run of Democratic success in recent years.
Is he as far left as Carrie Lake is perceived as far right? I mean, is he perceived that way?
I think that would be stretching things. Look, one thing that he has tried to make clear in this week of Sinema's retirement announcement, for example, is that Kyrsten Sinema helped negotiate a bipartisan border security bill that Ruben Gallego didn't love entirely, but he was willing to vote for it because he viewed it as something that would be on balance good for helping address the situation along the southern border. This is reflective of sort of the compromise spirit that was Kyrsten Sinema's brand, but also a pragmatism that Ruben Gallego sort of understands the need to, you know, do something along the border as a political matter that could be helpful to him. And he contrasted that with Kerry Lake, who rejected the bill before it was even publicly released. And I think it reflects sort of the reflexive conservatism that Lake has, and certainly kept her very much on the same page as Donald Trump. In Gallego's case, he has not even appeared alongside President Biden, and he is sort of keeping the White House at arm's length, at least for the moment. And he's looking for these kinds of compromise bills on issues that still seem to be problematic for Democrats in Arizona.
Do you have a sense who benefited most by Sinema's withdrawal?
You know, I think that on balance, it's probably more beneficial to Kerry Lake, but it would be a small plus sign at that. I think that by the end, Kyrsten Sinema was probably drawing more of her support from Republican-leaning voters than from Democrats. So in that sense, nominally, it would be a net benefit to Kerry Lake to have Sinema out. I think that it's a small difference, though, and because she won't be in the race for such an extended period of time in the race, I think that it allows both sides to sort of frame the issues and go at each other the way that that they would like to in a very conventional sense. So I don't know that it changes the dynamics a whole lot.
Ron Hansen is a national political reporter with the Arizona Republic. Ron, it was great having you on the show again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You'll be all right. You lost, you fell in with the con man who lies more than he breathes. Won't somebody please put this maniac in jail for one of his hundreds of crimes he's committed while in office? You lost, you voted for a loser who loses at everything. Even in 2016, he lost like 3 million votes and won on an antiquated technicality. I'm tired of having this conversation. Can we just please put it to bed? I'm scared your cult's jeopardizing the nation. Please stop.
Super Tuesday may have ended any remaining suspense of who the Democratic and Republican parties will put up as their presidential nominees, but it also signaled the beginning of what will be a month-long process of primaries to determine the candidates in the battle for the House and Senate. Democrats have a slight advantage in the Senate, with 3 independents combining with 48 Dems for a total of 51 seats. Republicans have 49. But of the 34 seats at stake this year, Democrats and the 3 Indies are defending 23 of them. The GOP would need a net pickup of just 2 seats for control, or just 1 and a Trump victory. If you assign the 3 vacant House seats to the party likely to claim them in special elections, Republicans control the lower chamber 221 to 214. Democrats need a pickup of 4 seats to regain the majority. Thus, in this very divided and topsy-turvy election year, Republicans could win a majority in the Senate, while the House could turn Democratic. A double switch like that has never happened in the nation's history. We'll be talking about this for the next 8 months, but let's start now with Jacob Rubashkin, the deputy editor of Inside Elections, the nonpartisan, invaluable newsletter that has everything you need to know about House, Senate, gubernatorial, and presidential primaries and general elections. Jacob, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Always happy to be here.
Well, thank you for that. And let's start with the biggest show in town from Tuesday's primaries, and that's the California Senate race for the seat formerly held by the late Dianne Feinstein. You know, it's a longtime Democratic seat, and which is probably likely to stay Democratic, but how we got to where we are today seems most interesting.
Yeah, for most of the last year, it looked as if the Senate race would ultimately be a Democrat versus Democrat clash in the general election in this very Democratic state, California. So either some combination of Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, and Barbara Lee, the 3 members of Congress running for this seat in the general election. But what ultimately ended up happening is the late entry of former baseball star Steve Garvey as a Republican created the potential and then the outcome of a more traditional Democrat versus Republican general election featuring Garvey as the Republican and Adam Schiff as the Democrat, a race that Schiff is heavily favored to win.
You mentioned that that's the traditional way of getting our nominees, but California has this unique system, right?
Yeah, so the top two vote-getters in the all-party primary, both Democrats, Republicans, Independents, everyone runs on the same primary ballot. The top two vote-getters, regardless of party, progress to the general election. So that creates the possibility of any sort of permutation, Democrat versus Republican, Democrat versus Democrat, Republican versus Republican. And that's how there was both the potential of a Schiff-Porter race and also a Schiff-Garvey race. But you know, Adam Schiff, of course, knew this and knew that it would be far easier to defeat Steve Garvey, a Republican, in the general election than it would Katie Porter, a fellow Democrat and another one of the Democratic Party's best fundraisers. So he pulled out all of the stops to not just boost his own campaign, but actually boost Steve Garvey, spend a lot of money on his behalf to get him into that number two spot and into the general election.
Right. Not so much to praise Steve Garvey, but to say, look, I can't believe how conservative Steve Garvey is. I can't believe what a Trumper Steve Garvey is. And then, of course, by saying that, he tells Republicans, wow, this guy may be a really good candidate.
Yeah, it's something that we have seen California candidates from both parties engage in ever since the state overhauled its primary system. The notion of boosting an opponent in order to get a weaker general election matchup is not something that Adam Schiff created, but it is something that he was able to execute very well because he's raised so much money that he could run essentially what came down to two parallel Senate campaigns, one for himself and then one, like you mentioned, nominally anti-Garvey, but in fact pro-Garvey in the ears of the Republican voters in California who like Trump, who like conservative candidates, and who heard all those TV ads, tens of millions of dollars in TV ads, about just how conservative and Trumpy Steve Garvey was.
And I think this tactic goes back to at least Claire McCaskill in Missouri in 2012 when she attacked the most conservative, most right-wing Republican candidate, Todd Akin, remember him of the famous legitimate rape campaign, and she said how he's too conservative for Missouri, and Republicans said, really? Okay, we'll vote for him, and then she clobbered him in November.
Exactly. This is a time-honored political maneuver that Schiff executed, I would argue, as well as McCaskill did over a decade ago.
One thing that wasn't expected, or maybe it was, but the fact is Katie Porter has not shown to be a good loser. She hasn't congratulated Schiff, and she's still talking about that the election was rigged. She sounds very Carrie Lake in the process.
There are legitimate reasons for her to be frustrated about how this race ended up. The way in which Schiff boosted Garvey is not something that I think most people would generally think of as kind of the most above board of politics. It does carry with it a little bit of gamesmanship. That's not to say that it was illegal or wrong or illegitimate, but I understand why she is frustrated with how things turned out. That said, of course, we could all see this coming from a million miles away. The Schiff folks were never particularly shy about this being part of their strategy. And like you said, we've seen it happen in elections for over a decade now. And Porter had a lot of money herself. She had a really strong team around her. She should have been ready for this possibility and ultimately wasn't able to figure out a counter strategy. But look, it's not entirely surprising that there are some sour grapes here. And especially if you go back and remember that Katie Porter actually announced her Senate bid for this seat before Dianne Feinstein passed away. And that was something that And before Feinstein even announced that she was not going to seek re-election. And that was something that I think really rubbed a lot of California Democrats, particularly in the political establishment, the wrong way, that she jumped the gun in her pursuit of this Senate seat. And so she has never been one to toe the party line, especially when it comes to the internal politics of the California Democratic Party. And so it's not particularly surprising that she's still not kind of falling in line behind Schiff as quickly as he might have liked.
Well, I guess we could say the good news for the Democrats is that the party won't be fighting with itself for the next 8 months. It'll be, you know, it'll be Schiff against Garvey rather than Schiff against Porter. But the bad news is that they've lost two progressive champions in the process, Katie Porter and Barbara Lee. Now, Barbara Lee is 77 years old and has probably run her last race, but Porter is only 50, and it's hard to see her disappear from the political scene.
I don't think we've seen the last of Katie Porter. She has a national following. She's got a massive donor network, and there will be ample opportunities for her within California or at the national level, perhaps in the near and not so near future. But her decision to run for Senate did open up that highly competitive House district that she's held since 2018. That's really where the issue is for Democrats defending that seat. It's already a swing seat, and the candidate that ultimately won the nomination has some pretty serious baggage that he's going to have to contend with in the general election. So there are some knock-on ramifications to Porter's decision to leave Congress to try and run for the Senate seat.
I think the California House seat that really caught my eye was the seat of David Valadao. He's one of the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump, and I think he's the only one standing, other than the other nine were either retiring or defeated in primaries or whatever. And Valadao, basically, it's another swing district. And he's been battling both Democrats and Republicans. And maybe because it's such a swing district, that's why he voted to impeach Trump to begin with.
Yeah, and there is one other, at least. Dan Newhouse in Washington State also voted to impeach Trump, and he is still in Congress. Okay. and likely to return. But Valadao, absolutely an interesting one, comes from this district in the Central Valley that tends to vote Democratic, but is among the least educated districts, the poorest districts. It has one of the lowest numbers of actual citizen voting age population. There are a lot of immigrants who live in the district, and so turnout is low naturally because of the demographics of the district, and then because there are just fewer voters overall, it often casts some of the least votes of any congressional district in the country. And so what that means is that the potential for upset is always far greater.
You know, I don't think the district I'm about to talk about is in danger of leaving Republican control, but it's just kind of ironic that, you know, last year, or in 2022, the Republicans finally gained back, you know, control of the House, and Kevin McCarthy was one of the instrumental leaders of getting this, making this happen for so long, and he's gone from the scene. It's just, I don't know, just, you know, you see somebody all the time, you think they have unlimited future, and boom, before you can say the words, Matt Gaetz, he's gone.
Yeah, look, the absence of McCarthy is being felt acutely by these California members in precarious races. He was their number one champion. He raised a ton of money for them, and it was really in his interest to have them around. It was a real embarrassment in 2018 when California Republicans were nearly wiped out. They were cut down to their lowest numbers of any recent memory, maybe in history.
In Orange County, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we saw, you know, Ronald Reagan said Orange County was where good Republicans go after they die. and all of a sudden, Democrats held all the Orange County seats. you know, there were after the 2018 elections, California had 53 House seats back then. There were 46 Democrats and 7 Republicans. And that was a real embarrassment. And McCarthy worked his tail off to turn things around in 2020, and he did. They picked up a whole bunch of seats in 2020, and then they picked up more seats in 2022. And so he really had a vested interest in these members who sit in these blue competitive districts. I don't think Mike Johnson has the same kind of interest in kind of blue state Republicans who aren't necessarily so in line with him ideologically. McCarthy was never really an ideological warrior. He wanted the votes. But Johnson approaches it from a bit of a different angle. So for the Republicans in tough races in California, and I would extend this to Republicans in tough races in New York as well, it really hurts to have lost McCarthy as your champion and as your fundraiser ahead of this really important election.
The second biggest state on Super Tuesday was Texas, and the I guess the only question there, well, I mean, Colin Allred, the Democratic congressman, was from the beginning the Democratic frontrunner to take on Senator Ted Cruz, and maybe the only question was whether he could do it without a runoff, and as it turned out, he did. So in that sense, that's good news for the Democrats.
Absolutely. This was a good showing for Colin Allred, who was always clearly the strongest candidate of the Democratic hopefuls in this Senate race. But Texas is such a big state. It is so difficult and so expensive to run a statewide campaign there that for a congressman from Dallas, he had his work cut out for him, no matter how strong he was on paper. Good news for Democrats that he avoided a runoff, because had he been forced into overtime with his main opponent, State Senator Rolon Gutierrez, he would have had to have spent a lot more time and money on his left flank. And all the while, Ted Cruz would have been able to continue fundraising at a very strong clip. I mean, Cruz is one of the strongest fundraisers in the Republican Party. And Allred would have lost valuable time ahead of November. Allred already needs everything to go right for him in order to pull off an upset in Texas. I mean, this is Texas we're talking about, and I know it's gotten a little bit more Democratic over the years, but it is still tough, tough sledding.
You know, I was just saying what you said. I mean, every couple of years, Democrats say, oh, you know, the demographics are changing. This year, we're going to win. And, of course, they never win. And I guess you could make a case that Ted Cruz is maybe the only marginally vulnerable senator the Republicans have, but it's one thing to say that the demographics are changing. It's another to say that Allred can win this.
We have this race rated as likely Republican. We see Ted Cruz as the clear favorite, but we also see it as on the battlefield in a way that no other Republican-held Senate seat really is. There is hard evidence that Texas is getting better for Democrats. It's just not getting better as fast as a lot of Democrats would have thought or hoped a decade, two decades ago. But the reality is, Cruz only won by 3 points in 2018. John Cornyn only won by 10 points in 2020, which was the last time Texas had a race with a presidential election, of course. But the Democratic nominee there, MJ Hagar, had to go to a runoff, and that really sapped her momentum and resources. So there are signs that the state is improving. The demographics are getting better for them. I don't think they're there yet, but I also think that Ted Cruz is a uniquely unpopular figure, and that creates the opportunity for a Democrat under the best of circumstances to make a real run for it.
I don't expect us to focus that much on them this year, but one gubernator possibility in North Carolina is Republican Mark Robinson. And he's running against Josh Stein. So Josh Stein is the attorney general. Mark Robinson is the lieutenant governor. That race could be a doozy.
Oh, yeah. This will be the number one gubernatorial race of the cycle. It's an open seat. It's a state that both parties are always highly competitive in. Republicans do very well in North Carolina at the federal level. The Democrats have struggled to win the state at the presidential or Senate level in every election, every recent election except for 2008, but they always get super, super close. But at the gubernatorial level, Democrats are actually quite strong in North Carolina. When Pat McCrory won his election in 2012, he became one of the only Republicans to successfully win the North Carolina gubernatorial mansion in the last, I want to say, 40 years. It's been quite some time.
And he got defeated for re-election, right?
Exactly. In a year that Trump was winning the state, right? An incumbent Republican governor lost North Carolina at the same time that Trump was winning the presidential election at the top of the ticket. So this is a state that likes to split its tickets. They like to vote for Democrats for governors. They also like to have really close races.
But explain though, I want you to explain why Mark Robinson is so controversial.
Well, he has a long and well-documented history of making homophobic remarks, misogynistic remarks, anti-Semitic remarks. He is on tape saying all sorts of things about gay people, about women, about Jews that rub a lot of people the wrong way.
You think?
I mean, he has called homosexuality filth. He has said that women aren't called to leadership. He made a comment that got surfaced recently about how he wanted to go back. He was making a larger point, but the clip that got passed around was how he said, I want to go back to when women didn't have the right to vote. He has...
And he's African. He's African-American, and let's point that out, too.
Yes, yes. He is one of the more prominent Black Republicans, certainly in the state and about to be on the national stage. He, you know, has a real shot at winning this race. I mean, North Carolina, these contests are tight. Even if he loses in a landslide, that'll be 4 points, right? I mean, this is the electorate that North Carolina has sorted itself into is one that is pretty baked in. So on the other side of the aisle, of course, we've got Josh Stein. He's the sitting state attorney general. He is the chosen successor to Roy Cooper, the incumbent governor. He followed a similar path to Cooper. I mean, Cooper was attorney general for 4 terms before he running against McCrory in 2016. Josh Stein took over for him in 2016, has won 2 very close statewide elections, is a strong fundraiser, and is a good candidate for Democrats. But this is going to be a barn burner of a race from now until Election Day.
Just startles me that given what's on Mark Robinson's resume and the things he's said and the things he's written, and to say that it's going to be a close race is just mind-boggling, but I do understand that. Listen, are there any states coming up whose primaries you're especially watching or incumbents who could be in trouble?
So March 19th is the primary in Ohio. This is one of the top Senate states this cycle. Democrat Sherrod Brown is trying to hold on to a state that is going to vote for Donald Trump by a hefty margin in the presidential election. He needs to outrun Joe Biden at the top of the ticket by probably 8 or 9 points if he wants to win. And that's a tough sell for him. Republicans are going to pick their nominee out of 3 options, Secretary of State Frank LaRose, wealthy state senator and businessman Matt Dolan, and wealthy guy Bernie Moreno, who has made a lot of money originally through car dealerships and lately through entrepreneurship. And any 3 of them, I think, could win that primary. The polling has been very tight. Moreno has an endorsement from Donald Trump. That matters. That helps. But it's not as dispositive as perhaps Trump's endorsement of J.D. Vance was in the 2022 Republican primary, where Trump really elevated Vance to the top of the pack with his endorsement. I think it's given Moreno a bit of a boost, but Matt Dolan has a lot of money. Frank LaRose has a lot of name ID. These are 3 credible candidates. Either any 3 of them are going to give Sherrod Brown a real run for his money. I think this is probably the toughest race that he'll have to run in his Senate career. And so the no pressure, but the fate of the Democratic majority in the Senate will come down to whether he can hold on or whether he gets washed away, no matter who the nominee is.
I guess if any Democrat could win in Ohio, maybe it is Sherrod Brown, but that doesn't necessarily mean he is going to win because the demographics, here we go again, but the demographics are changing.
Ohio has only gotten more difficult for Democrats, and I think it's an open question whether Sherrod can hold on. He certainly has worked hard to cultivate the kind of blue-collar brand that is in line with where the state remains culturally, but politically, this is a real tough challenge for him. He was able to outrun the top of the ticket in the governor's race in 2018, but he was doing so against an opponent, Jim Renacci, who he was able to outspend, I think, by a factor of 7-1. And of course, that was a really great Democratic year overall. So it's going to be tough for him. I mean, this is the first time that he is rowing against the political environment. If you look back at 2006, when he beat Mike DeWine, that was a Democratic wave year. 2012, Obama carries Ohio. And 2018, of course, that Democratic year as well. So this is a new ball game for Sherrod. He's a strong fundraiser. He's got a lot of appeal. But we have this race rated as a toss-up, and I think that's where it's going to remain for most of the rest of the cycle.
Jacob Rubashkin is the deputy editor of Inside Elections, the nonpartisan political newsletter. A lot of good stuff here, Jacob. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's show. Don't forget, you can always find my political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet me at Ken Rudin or shoot me a message on the show's Facebook page. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is made possible thanks to the support of our listeners and donors. Your generous contributions are most appreciated. Keep them coming at krpoliticaljunkie.com/donate. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. Please stay safe. I'll see you soon.